Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. Today's podcast is about propaganda. War propaganda, election propaganda, and President Vladimir Putin's use of the interview he granted to Tucker Carlson for the purpose of signaling, messaging, and more. And my guest today on The Week Ahead in Russia is Dr. Ian Garner, an expert on Russian war propaganda at Queen's University in Ontario and author of the new book, Z Generation, Russia's Fascist Youth, which was published last year. Thanks very much for joining me, Ian.
Thanks very much for having me back, Steve, and what's been a very fascinating week in Russia.
Yeah, unbelievable. Great to have you on the show. Often unbelievable these days, I'm afraid, but great to have you on the show again. I think it's certainly the first time this year, but we had some great discussions in the past. Let's talk first about Tucker Carlson's interview, the only interview Putin has granted to a Western media figure since he launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine nearly 2 years ago, despite countless requests from the Western media. He also asked very few questions or gave very few questions to Western media outlets at his press conference at the end of last year, despite the hands shooting up. Now, much has been said about Carlson's exchange with Putin, but I'd be interested in your viewpoint, I guess mainly about how Putin approached it, what he may have wanted out of it, and what actually came across. Maybe what it says about his aims for the war and for relations with the West. I'll just say two things about my impressions, informed in large part by media reports and analyst comments that have emerged since the interview was posted, I believe it was Thursday. One is that, as many have pointed out, if Putin wanted to impress or influence audiences in the United States and elsewhere who may be receptive to his frequent messaging about gender issues, what he calls traditional values and such, he did a poor job. He barely mentioned those matters. And he also did little, I would say, to advance his claim that a supposed threat from the United States and NATO forced or was one of the main reason for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Instead, he focused heavily on false or other false historical arguments, starting the interview with a lecture that went back centuries and lasted about half an hour, I believe. And while Putin's remarks in recent years have strongly suggested that his main motive for invading Ukraine was an obsession with Ukraine and the desire to subjugate it, this interview only seemed to reinforce that impression. Ian, apologies, I don't want to shape this discussion too much, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on the interview.
So I broadly speaking, I agree. I think overall this has been a big victory for Putin. Simply getting an American provocateur, we'll call Carlson, because I don't think it's right to call him a journalist, but an American provocateur to come over to Moscow, be treated with such excitement and enthusiasm by the Russian media, to draw in Western media into speaking about Putin, Putin's war goals, and Putin's version of history and version of reality, because that's what we're talking about. We're not just talking about the past. We're talking about a perspective on the nature of being, which I'll get onto in a second. Simply by doing that, and especially by bringing in somebody who is, let's be clear, not a minor figure. Carlson is sidelined by the mainstream media, but has a huge audience online, and of course seems to have a direct line to Donald Trump as well. That in and of itself is a victory. Regardless of, and it is really easy to get lost in the nitty-gritty details and to say, well, Putin could have pushed forward this messaging about gender issues much more strongly, especially when Carlson almost invited him to do so. But that's to miss the bigger point, which is getting the attention in and of itself is a win. And boy, did Putin do that. The fact that we are talking about it right now suggests that he's won on that front, and we are chasing Putin's coattails, trying to make sense of it. But I just want to draw attention to this question of history a little bit more, and the idea of reality and fake realities, history and fake history, which undoubtedly is what Putin presented us. Because when the Russian state talks about history, it is not talking about the reality of what happened in the past. And I don't think even Putin really believes that he is talking about the empirical reality of what happened in the past. The Russian state approaches history as if it were myth. It approaches history as a religious group would do. And that is to interpret and reinterpret history and historical events along symbolic lines. And so it doesn't matter that Poland didn't actually invite or force Nazi Germany to invade Poland at the end of the 1930s, as Poland suggest, as Putin suggested that Poland had. It's a suggestion that this is a historical event of an archetype. This is the type of event that occurs in history, and therefore this is the type of event that is occurring today that is causing Russia to have to act in a particular way. And I thought Putin's comments on religion were quite interesting when Carlson asked him, "But aren't you, as a Christian, somebody opposed to killing?" I forget the exact question, but it was pretty close to that. And Putin said, "Well, no, we've got to do it." And then went off to talk about these sort of symbolic ideas about the Russian soul and Dostoevsky. He's not talking about reality. He is literally talking about fiction, and he knows it. So he's thinking in these sort of religious mythical terms.
Yeah, absolutely. Really fascinating. I think those are great points about, I'm always sort of wondering, how much Putin believes of what he says. And, in the past, I always thought, very little. And more recently, people have argued he believes a lot of the things. But I think, you're probably right on the mark saying, he's not trying to convey what he even believes are the facts about history. He is, he is doing it for another purpose. And also interesting about, at the kind of bottom line, yes, there's been a lot of, I guess, back and forth about, in a way similar to a summit. You have the media talking about zero sum, kind of who won, when you had a Soviet US summit, or a Russian US summit, and did this leader or that leader get their point across? But I think you're suggesting, well, bottom line, he kind of just the fact of it, is, is a victory for Putin. And there's a lot to that, I think. So I guess I'd like to go on to the next question, about Putin's propaganda more broadly, Kremlin propaganda related to Russia's war in Ukraine, and to the presidential election, which is being held March 15th to 17th, just over 1 month away. Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine reaches the 2-year mark on February 24th, though Putin apparently believed the war, which the Kremlin still insists on calling the special military operation, would be over in Russia's favor, in a matter of days or weeks. But the war is still going obviously in a very major way. As for the election, given the Kremlin's control over all kinds of levers nationwide, it's certain to hand Putin a new six-year term by a large margin, barring some massive and unexpected event. But Putin presumably wants to win by a very large margin. Some numbers have been thrown around. I think his spokesman Peskov once said that he could win 95% or 90%, obviously a unrealistic amount. And the fact that a would-be candidate, Boris Nadezhdin, who was a critic of the war, was barred from the ballot last week after a signature campaign showed a substantial measure of public support, suggests that there's a limit to the Kremlin's confidence about this process. So broad question, Ian, what are you seeing in terms of the Russian state's war and election propaganda? Has the war propaganda been changing at all as it continues? And what tack is the Kremlin taking as this non-competitive election approaches?
So I would say that those two issues, that is the issue of the war propaganda and the election propaganda, are inextricably linked. And the headline message is very clearly one of inevitability right now. And I don't think the nature of the propaganda, the forms, the mediums in which it's being spread have really changed in any substantial way over the last 2 years, because we are almost at the 2-year mark of the war. Certainly, we're seeing different propaganda forms in terms of the way that the West is targeted, but that's a different question entirely. If we focus purely on the Russian audience, then we still see the same mix of talk shows and troll networks, bot networks, intermingled with true believers posting online, and much of the action is happening online on VK, on Telegram, and in particular on TikTok, where lots of younger Russians are getting their news nowadays. But when we look at the narratives, the war narrative, and actually this is something that did come up in the Carlson interview, is, and has been for the last few months, the West is weakening. Western support is beginning slowly to crack, slowly to evaporate. Ukrainian resistance is beginning to crack. Ukrainian people are getting tired of the war. Russia, on the other hand, is getting its act together. Yes, there were mistakes made in the first few months of the war, but now we have a handle on things. The death toll seems to be slowing down at the front, whether it's reality or not. This is the story that's given, I should make clear. Mm-hmm. And that the Russian economy is resilient. And so we're seeing over and over again this story that if you can just wait it out, average Russian reading the newspaper or watching the television, wait another 2 months, wait another 6 months, another 12 months, all will be right in the world. And when we saw that in Carlson's interview, was in the way that Putin was talking about the emergence of a multipolar world order, which he spoke about in inevitable terms and suggested that America is fated to inevitable decline. Again, it's the narrative of just hold steady, and there's not a damn thing that anybody anywhere can do to change this. Therefore, fighting the war from Ukraine's perspective is futile, and counting on Russia's victory is something that you just have to do because Russia is going to win. Again, this is a very, there's a very religious reading of what history could be, right? Where history isn't contingent, nobody has agency in history. History simply unfolds step by step by step with certain inevitability. And thus we come to the election, which even by the standards of Putin's previous presidential elections has been a quiet affair. It's not been much heralded so far. There's been no huge speeches, no big editorial pieces from Putin in national newspapers. We haven't seen any big stadium parades yet. I'm sure that we will do in the next couple of 3 weeks, as the election is just over a month away. In particular, I would look out for the Day of the Defender of the Fatherland in about 10 days from now. That's always a major point for Russian patriots and the pro-military crowd. And Putin's often around presidential elections done a parade at the Luzhniki Stadium to show his latest slogans and latest ideas off. But I think we're in a point where the opposition has been eliminated. Boris Nadezhdin, the opposition candidate, if he was a real opposition candidate and not somebody who was put there as a stooge by the Kremlin and then perhaps withdrawn as they saw that maybe an opposition candidate might be too popular or too challenging to Putin, all of it seems totally under control from my perspective. There is no sense of a united opposition. There is no sense of a clear opposition narrative, and any oppositional activity that's more chaotic, like for example the protests in Bashkiria a couple of weeks ago, seem to have been stamped out. They seem to be isolated and don't seem to be having any real impact on what's happening in the political center.
Yeah, absolutely. It does strike me. I mean, as you said, there probably will be rallies. Maybe articles by Putin. In the coming weeks. It always strikes me how different, I guess, the election cycle is in Russia under Putin. Than from how it is in the United States or other countries. Where you have obviously the United States, the election is already kind of the campaign is already, in full gear. And in Russia, a month until the election and a few days, and there's just not that much happening. But as you say, I think it's more pronounced this year for those reasons. The opposition is crushed. And yes, Nadezhdin, it does seem like whatever happened to kind of generate his candidacy, the Kremlin seems to have decided that the kind of show of support, the idea that somebody who wants change, wants an end to the war, but also, it is running as an actual alternative to Putin, unlike the other candidates, is just something that can't be accepted. If he's going to get more than a couple percent percentage points in the vote. You mentioned, I just wanted to ask one other thing. You mentioned the war and the election are kind of intertwined inextricably. I'm trying to remember when it was, but towards the end of the year, Putin gave quite a grim speech in which he, pretty much said the war is here to stay. There's no, and it kind of, I think it surprised some people who would think that he was going to provide kind of an indication that there's not long to go. But he said, we still have the same goals, denazification, demilitarization, that sort of thing. So I'm wondering, do you think there'll be a change in the rhetoric kind of after the election is over with?
I think to answer that question, we have to turn our eyes to the United States. Because so much of Putin's strategy on the ground in Ukraine right now is predicated on support from America drying up. And so, as we talk about long election cycles, 9 months out from the election, if my math is correct, and I apologize, it's 7 a.m. when we're recording, so I may be off by a few weeks. 9 months out from the election, Putin and Putinists are already looking ahead and hoping desperately that Donald Trump will win. Donald Trump will have a friendly legislative body behind him, and that there will simply be no more funds and no more support to Ukraine. And Ukraine will have to fold, will have to parley for peace on probably unfavorable terms, that as a result, Russia, in tandem, will be able to exploit political divides in Ukraine, will be able to stoke up rifts, junctures, revanchism between different groups of people who will argue that the war should have been won, could have been won, could have been conducted in a different way, all the should have, would have, could have you can think of, while Russia retains its mostly united front, or at least gives the impression of doing so. And so I think we may see that the fighting in Ukraine will die down, but what we will certainly see is continued militarism from the Russian state and the continued rhetoric that Russia is in a bigger, broader kind of metaphysical battle with its enemies in the so-called collective West. And of course, there is a glaring contradiction here, right? On the one hand, we're hoping that a friendly Donald Trump and his friendly supporters, like lovely Tucker Carlson, will ride to Russia's rescue and help us out by abandoning Ukraine. And on the other hand, Putin contends that the collective West is an age-old eternal enemy in these religious terms, and therefore can't be trusted on any matter. So there is an impossibility in the rhetoric. It doesn't make sense, but that's what they're putting forward.
Right, absolutely. By the way, I think you're absolutely right about the nine months. Despite, well, thanks for joining me at 7 a.m. Your time, I really do appreciate it. I just, if you don't mind, just a follow-up question about you mentioned in discussing the Russian kind of propaganda aimed at Russians over the election. And I think you said, there have been some changes or just sort of various tacks taken by the Kremlin in terms of propaganda about the war, aimed at the West or the world. Would you mind sort of going into that a little bit more deeply?
Absolutely. I get the sense that looking back 2 years, now we've had a little bit of time to reflect, the Russian state was not really ready to propagandize the war to its own people, nor to propagandize the war abroad, because they expected to win fairly quickly. I don't know if the 3 days story is true or not. I'm not quite sure I believe it that they were that overconfident, but they expected to win within weeks and that Ukraine would somehow collapse, that the government would flee. And so they just didn't seem really ready to target particular audiences, let alone the broader West with particular messages. And so they mostly didn't really bother. They ceded that space to Ukraine. They ceded that space to liberals in the West for the better part of a year before really beginning to target hard. And you can see the targeting working, and the targeting is most obviously directed towards far right audiences in the West, in particular in the United States, to a lesser extent to the far left. We know about that horseshoe theory, in which the far right and the far left actually agree on some matters. And we see it on platforms like Twitter or X, which have become more friendly, which have allowed Russian state propagandists to host Twitter spaces. Alexander Dugin, the far right thinker, if you can call him that, although I think it's a stretch to call him a thinker, he hosted a Twitter space a few weeks ago, Q&A with a guy who was, a shill for the Russian government. They're really realizing that they have tools to access Western audiences directly, and that it doesn't just have to be covert influence operations like fake media accounts, fake Facebook groups, and fake trolls and bots that we saw during the or lead up to the 2016 American presidential election, for example. There is much more overt targeting of Western audiences through these sorts of figures online, and including politicians like Dmitry Medvedev, who talks to audiences through Twitter, X, and through Telegram, for example.
And I guess Tucker Carlson as well. That's another example of kind of a directly targeting. Well, thanks very much. I mean, that's really, I mean, that was pithy, but really great comment. I was unaware that Alexander Dugin had a Twitter space recently. I think that is kind of a sign of the times, I guess. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks very much for your insights, and thanks for joining me, Ian.
Well, thanks for having me.
All right. Hope we can do it again. Once again, I've been speaking to Dr. Ian Garner, an expert on Russian war propaganda at Queen's University in Ontario, and author of the new book, Z Generation: Russia's Fascist Youth, which was published last year. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Не стреляй, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.referl.org.